started discussing the gravitational field itself. And so for that, we needed to write an action for this gravitational field. So ideally, such action would depend on the metric and the first derivative of the metric. So then it's, of course, guaranteed that if I vary that action, I get second order equations for the metric. And there are no ghosts, there are no runaway solutions and stuff like that. So unfortunately, one cannot write such action, not at least not an action which would be diffeomorphism invariant, because I can always use the equivalence principle. I can always kill the first derivatives of the metric. I can always make the metric flat. And so there is no corresponding scale. So then what you have to do is that you have to really sort of live with the fact that my scalar, my Lagrangian density, will depend already on two derivatives of the metric. And so an example of such scalar density would be the Ricci scalar, which certainly depends on the first derivatives and second derivatives of the metric. And so now let's hope for the best that this still gives us some nice second order differential equations. And so now if you write down this action and you vary it with respect to the metric, you get three terms because Ricci scalar is just Ricci times the metric. So now if I vary this, I have to vary the square root of G. I have to vary this metric here. And then I have to vary the Ricci tensor here. Okay, so now surprise, surprise, the first two terms are super easy to calculate. And that's good because they immediately give the Einstein equations. They give that the Einstein tensor, capital G mu nu, equals to zero. On the other hand, this term is super painful to calculate. But the trick is that we don't need to calculate it because somebody can actually tell us that this cannot contribute. We know that it cannot contribute to the equations following Einstein's nose derivation. So this better be a boundary term, and indeed that is the case. So the last term does not contribute because it's a boundary term. The problem is that you cannot really make that boundary term to vanish, and that's why this action is actually ill-posed. But who cares, right? So this gives the right equations of motion. All right, so now let me just comment on this. So this is the most important result. And I'll just now start commenting on what, you know, what this means and what we can immediately say out of this. So first remark we already had yesterday is that if you are not in two dimensions, not in two space-time dimensions, so 1 plus 1, then you can equally write the Einstein equations as simply the Ricci tensor equals to zero. That comes from tracing out this equation by the metric. Then you conclude that the Ricci scalar has to be zero. But if the Ricci scalar is zero, then also the Ricci tensor has to be zero. So vacuum equations of Einstein are typically written in this form rather than in that form. So typically people just write Ricci equals to zero. So that's the first remark, trivial remark. So now the second remark is, why the hell, okay, so second remark is, if you look at the equation G mu nu equals to zero, then of course G mu nu depends on the metric, first derivative metric, and second derivative of the metric, right? That's how we derived it. So we have second order, of course these are partial differential equations for our metric, PDEs for the metric. G mu nu, right? So that's what the Einstein equations are. But then you start thinking, wait a minute, how can that happen, right? How could I start with an action which depends already on two derivatives of the metric? And I end up with the equations, which also have only two derivatives of the metric. So we have seen in the front-end course that actually if you start with a Lagrangian density for the particle or whatever, which depends on q double dot, then actually your equations of motion are fourth order equations of motion. They depend on q dot 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 dot, right? So why is this not the case? And the reason is precisely the same one as when we discussed the weird action. So when for the particle, our dependence of the Lagrangian on q double dot was actually through a total derivative. So now what you can show, so this can happen, so, so how is this possible? Is this possible when we started from the Lagrangian density, which was a function of g dg and d square of g. So naively you would expect, we would expect fourth order equations for the metric. Right, so that's what we shown for the particle. And this is what you, if you write down your Lagrange equations for this thing, that's what you would expect. But that's not the case, and the reason why it's not the case is that this thing here actually can be decomposed into two terms. One which is a total derivative, and one which depends only on the first derivatives of the metric. So the reason is, so reason for this, is that you can write the square root of g times r, you can decompose it into something which only depends on the first derivatives of the metric. So you can write it in terms of square root of minus g r tilde, which depends only on g and the first derivative of the metric, and a total derivative plus d mu r hat, which depends on g and dg, precisely as we've seen in the front-end course, okay, and the r mu. So we have a total divergence of something which depends on the first derivatives. So that this total divergence, in fact, brings down the second derivative of the metric, right, which we see here. But it can, that piece can be written as a total divergence, and then we have something which does not depend on the second derivatives. All right, and so this is precisely the reason why. So when basically what contributes to the equations of motion is this part here. So this gives us the Einstein equations, and this gives us the boundary term. So now you may be asking, why the hell don't I start with just this piece here, right? Can I just start with this piece here and just don't consider that?
You made it work.
Yeah, it works. It's a surprise. It's a magic, dark magic. All right, so can we start just with this piece? What do you think?
But it didn't work this morning. He's talking about the board.
Yeah, the board.
I know. Yeah. It's a dark magic. Anyway, okay, so can we just start with this piece here?
Maybe not a scalar?
It's not a scalar, right? It's precisely the same problem as we started with, right? There is no any scalar which would actually depend only on the first derivative of the metric. So this piece is not a scalar. Of course, that piece is not a scalar. But when you add them together, they actually produce a scalar, which is the richest scalar here. Okay, so you can decompose it in this way, and so there is a beautiful derivation of this. You know what this piece has to be, in order it's really I can write it in this form, this plus that, in Landau and Lifshitz. So there is a beautiful. I encourage you to read that section. It's just two pages, as always, this Landau and Lifshitz, right? It's just two pages where they derive everything, and they motivate how the action has to look like. And they derive what this r tilde is. So C Landau and Lifshitz. And so what they actually conclude is that this r tilde, well, what would you expect? So are there any guesses what this r tilde can be? So it depends on the metric and the first derivative of the metric. So is there some object like that? It's the Christoffel symbol, right? So what actually this r tilde is gamma gamma minus gamma gamma. All right, so this r tilde is g mu nu, and then gamma alpha mu beta gamma beta mu alpha minus gamma alpha mu nu gamma beta alpha beta. And that's what it is. And you see, so it's really gamma gamma minus gamma gamma term. You see immediately this cannot be a tensor, right? Gamma is not a tensor, this is not a tensor. But you can actually, and this piece is precisely the one which gives you the Einstein equations. Okay, so this gives the Einstein equations. All right, so that was remark number two. Question?
How can something that's not a tensor give you a tensor equation?
I don't know. It can.
Probably because of the Yamin.
Right? I don't know.
How can we decompose R into those two terms?
Well, okay, so R is some horrible expression, right? So you know what the horrible expression is for the Riemann tensor. So now I have to contract all the indices, so I will have horrible expression just d gamma minus d gamma plus gamma 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 gamma. So basically what this is telling you is that R tilde is the gamma gamma part, and this is the d gamma part. Okay, so which actually stands here. So you just, you know, you have to look at how it is written explicitly down, and it just split it into two pieces. And so then you observe that the other piece can be written as a total divergence. And the remaining piece is this nice piece here, which gives you the right equations. OK, so remark number three. However beautiful the Einstein-Hilbert action is, it is pretty ugly. Right? Why is it ugly? Is that we precisely have this boundary term, which we have to deal with. And if you really have to calculate what the variation of delta R mu nu is, then it's quite complicated. Okay, so Einstein-Hilbert action is complicated. Why is it complicated? In that sense, is that, you know, it's understood as an action for the metric. Okay. Because we understand it as Einstein-Hilbert depends on the metric, right? So it's a functional of the metric, and so it depends on the metric. But of course, since it depends on the metric, it automatically contains two derivatives of the metric, so it's second order in the metric. Okay, so this is second order in metric, and so the corresponding action or the corresponding formalism is called second order formalism. Second order formalism. Because we have two derivatives of the metric appearing explicitly here, right? Okay, so now the question is, can we do any better? Can we actually kill the boundary term, sort of, and can we simplify our calculation? And the answer is yes, there's beautiful different action, which is called Palatini action. So more useful, more simple and useful is Palatini action, Palatini action. So now it's basically the same action, but now you don't understand it as an action of metric only, but you understand it as an action of the metric and the connection. Okay, so now we have S Palatini. And so this will be a functional of the metric and the connection. OK? Okay, and so why is this beautiful is that I can now write the same action, but, so this is 1 over 16 pi g d4 of x square root of minus g, and then I would have the Ricci scalar, which again, the same trick applies. The Ricci scalar is just Ricci tensor times the metric, right? So it's now g mu nu times r mu nu. Okay, but now look at the beauty. So when we are discussing the Ricci tensor for the first time, we just concluded it only depends on the connection. It doesn't explicitly depend on the metric. It only depends on the connection. So it's precisely like Riemann tensor is gamma gamma minus gamma gamma plus d gamma minus d gamma. So there is no any metric explicitly. The metric is always hiding through the connection, right? So of course, if I do a contraction, this is still only a function of gamma. Right? So this is still only a function of gamma. So then you see that basically the dependence on the metric is just here. So that's the metric dependent part. Metric dependent part. And that's super simple. It's just the square root of g times g mu nu. And then we have an ugly connection. Connection part. Which is quite complicated. Okay. But anyway, so this is the action. And now, because you understand it as function of two things, as function of the metric and of the connection, you treat them independently. So that's why you do the variation of this thing with respect to the metric. So the variation with respect to the metric, delta g. Well, if I do delta g, I just have to vary this term and that term, right? This is a function of gamma, so I don't vary that. But if I vary this term and that term, and you look at the Einstein-Hilbert action, then we vary the first term and the second term, we got the Einstein equations. So delta g gives you immediately that g mu nu equals to zero, right? That's precisely the first two terms which we have here. So this is an immediate consequence. Of course, I am not done. I still have to vary this action with respect to the connection. Okay, so then I do delta gamma. So now I have to vary this ugly part. But of course, the ugly part is still much, much nicer in terms of the gamma than in terms of the metric, right? So each gamma is a particularly complicated function of the metric. But now I don't treat it as a function of the metric. Instead, I treat it only as a function of gamma. So this is much simpler calculation. So if you do variation of this thing with respect to gamma, it's also pretty simple. So do you know what you get? If you vary this with respect to gamma, you get some equation of motion for the gamma. And this equation of motion better agree with general relativity. So it actually gives you that gamma is nothing else in terms of the metric than the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so this is an equation of motion for gamma. And it's simple to show is that it just tells you that gamma is a Christoffel symbol. So it is actually related to the metric, but now by the Christoffel relation. Yes?
It's related to the torsion.
OK, so what I assume here is that in this action, still gamma is symmetric in the last two indices. So I'm assuming no torsion. So this is just without torsion. Okay. So that's the assumption here. But the fact that metricity is zero automatically follows from varying this action with respect to gamma. All right, so now, of course, because here everything depends at most on one derivative of my field. So actually, there is no derivative of the metric anywhere in the action for the metric. But there are derivatives of gamma, right, hiding in this R mu nu. Okay, so but there are at most first order derivatives, right? So then this is called first order formalism. is a first order formalism. And it's really nice, much nicer than actually, you know, that thing here. Of course, it's much.
And solves all problems that we.
It sort of solves all problems, yeah. All right. Oh no, it's again. So this is much nicer formalism. Of course, now people doing supergravity, they are doing 1.5 formalism. Okay. So 1.5 formalism is something in between. So what they basically do is that they write this Sabatini action here. And then they say, well, I have to vary this action with respect to the metric. That's I want to get equations for the metric. So that gives you the Einstein equations immediately. And then they say, well, in GR, I know that actually metric has zero metricity. And so that's why my connection has to be the Christoffel connection. So they never bother to actually do variations with delta gamma. They just do variation of delta G of the Palatini action, and they get the Einstein equations immediately. So that's the 1.5 formalism, which of course is a big cheat, but anyway, it's also used. Okay. So questions? Yes?
Why does so the Arminian depends on the derivatives of gamma.
Mm-hmm.
So the equation of motion of gamma should be a differential equation, not only define gamma, right? Because I would get if you get an equation of the form gamma equals something, if it didn't depend on the derivative.
Do it. Do it. the statement is, it just gives you the algebraic relation. Well, not algebraic, it gives you that gamma is given in terms of the derivative of the metric.
So do we need to integrate that part to move the delta over the gamma to delta G?
Say it again. If
I have same question with Ivan, so.
No. So first, I vary it just with respect to G, right? I don't touch gamma. Second, I just vary it with respect to gamma. I don't touch G, right? But of course, the result will still depend on G. So these two are coupled, right? So because they appear simultaneously in the action. So anyway, try to do it. It's much simpler than actually varying delta R mu nu in with respect to the metric. All right. So fourth remark. Is that, so let's call it other curvature invariants. So basically what I was telling you is that, well, we cannot find any scalar which would depend only on the first derivative of the metric. We have to go to two derivatives of the metric. And then I told you, well, the simplest scalar you can think of is the Ricci scalar, right? But there are many other scalars which depend on the second derivative of the metric. So for example, you may be thinking about R square, Ricci scalar square, or you may be thinking about R mu nu, or you may be thinking about R mu nu kappa lambda, R mu nu kappa lambda. And so on. But you can also go to higher derivatives if you want. But all these things have only two derivatives in them, right? All these have only g, dg, and d square of g, right, in them. So now you may be thinking, okay, so actually, was my choice r, you know, l equal to r, just a simple choice, or can I actually start adding these things here? What do you think? Can I put R square or R mu nu square?
Only in arbitrary dimensions.
Uh-huh, that's the right answer.
Yeah, I was thinking that, yeah, because at the end, the Ricci scalar comes from the Ricci tensor on the Ricci tensor, so I
think they are related. So you think you can. So okay, so very good. So now, but notice is right. We had this second derivative here, but we could write the second derivative terms in this special form d mu r mu, right? This is only true for the Ricci scalar. If you start writing r square, you won't be able to get rid of the second derivatives in this way, that it will be a total derivative of something. So actually, there is a theorem. by a lava log. Who was a professor at UW? okay, and then it says that in four dimensions, if you are in 4D, four-dimensional space-time, the Einstein of L equals to R is the only possibility. Is the only possibility up to some topological terms that you do not modify the equations of motion, up to topological terms, and the cosmological constant if you want, but let me discuss cosmological constant in a minute, up to topological terms, which yields second order equations of motion for the metric. Equations for the metric. Okay, so there is a uniqueness theorem basically telling you if I try anything else than L equal to R, I will fail. I will necessarily end up with equations which are higher order in the derivatives of the metric. Of course, such equations are bad typically. Okay, so this is in 4D. In higher D, you can do actually more. That was the right answer there. So if you are in higher dimensions, so some of these topological terms in higher dimensions are no longer topological. And so you can have additional, you can have special combinations of these objects, and you can end up with second order differential equations, but only in higher dimensions. The corresponding gravities are all very well known. You just prescribe what is the precise combination of these things here. And these are called Lovelock gravities. In higher dimensions, we have also Lovelock gravities. So basically, the Einstein equations are unique in four dimensions. But if you go to higher dimensions, you go to five dimensions, you also have Gauss-Bonnet gravity. And if you go to sufficiently high dimension, you have other Lovelock gravities. So for example, you can have Gauss-Bonnet gravity. Which you will have very painful experience with if you take gravitational physics course. Okay? All right. So basically, the statement is this is it, and nothing else I can write down in four dimensions. It's just the Einstein-Hilbert action or its Palatini version. Questions? If not, then so far we just discussed pure gravity. Let's add matter, okay? So adding matter, so E Einstein equations So the simplest thing is to add cosmological constant. Okay, so this thing was just in vacuum, but if you want to add cosmological constant, all you have to do is that you have to add to the Ricci scalar just minus a constant. Okay, so lambda, it's very simple to add, and you just replace R with R minus 2 lambda. So that will be your Einstein-Hilbert action with lambda. Okay. Yes?
Could we also say that lambda is in fact a part of the
of matter? Yes. Yes, of course. So it depends on what you want to do. So relativists would put lambda into the geometry. So they would say, you know, it's something which gives me nice Bianchi identity and stuff like that. it's guaranteed to work. So they would write lambda on the left-hand side. So they would have equations, which I will just now write down. So you would have, of course, lambda g mu nu equals to 0. So that's our equation, Einstein equation, in the presence of lambda. And that's how a relativist would do it. Cosmologists would, on the other hand, treat lambda as part of matter. And they would just write this guy on the right-hand side. Okay, and they would just write g mu nu is equal to minus lambda g mu nu. So they would treat lambda g mu nu as a t mu nu of the corresponding matter, of the corresponding cosmological constant matter. Okay, so it's just a matter of taste. Anyway, so that's how you add lambda. So now, what is super beautiful is that if you do have lambda, okay, there is another beautiful way how you can write the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, and you will derive in tutorial today. If you have lambda and you are in vacuum, there is another super nice action, which is called Eddington's action. So S Eddington So if you look at the actions which we have here, well, that one is a little bit hiding. But so the first one only depends on the metric, as the Einstein-Hilbert action. It just depends on the metric. The second one depends on both, on the metric and on the connection. So finally, the Eddington one depends only on the connection. Okay, so this is only a function of gamma. And it's simply written as 1 over 8 pi g lambda. It's only true if you have non-trivial lambda, but we do, so it's fine. So the lambda explicitly appears here. And then it's a d4 of x. And then, which quantity depends on lambda, on gamma only?
R
mu nu, right? Not the Ricci scalar, that also depends on the metric, right? I have to have g mu nu there, but r mu nu does. So now how do I form almost a scalar out of r mu nu? Oh, you could square it. But that would be, you would be, you know, higher order in cabbage. So that wouldn't work.
No, but squaring also would involve another g, right?
Right. So, okay, so surprise, surprise. This is actually sort of like higher curvature, but not. So can I make out of the metric almost a scalar? What scalar can I make out of the metric?
G mu nu.
Oh, okay, that would be trivial scalar. But you can take a determinant of the metric. It's almost a scalar, right? It's a scalar density. Okay, so why not to take a determinant of r mu nu? So this is determinant of r mu nu, which is only a function of gamma. And then, of course, this is negative, so you put a minus, then you take a square root. It's a super ugly action, but you can just write action in terms of the gamma only. You will derive it in tutorial today. Okay, surprisingly, it's super easy to derive it. You will see. But if you have lambda, this is another action, which is just in terms of the gamma. All right. Isn't that beautiful? You can play with all actions here. So we have three actions now. Yes?
Why do we need lambda to write that action? In
The construction does not work if you don't have lambda. Except it doesn't. You will see in your tutorial today. If you can write something like this without lambda, I will be very happy. But I don't know how to do it. Okay. So we can add lambda easily like this. But of course, we can add other matter as well. So other matter. Well, all you do is that you just add to the Einstein-Hilbert action, you add the matter part. So now the total action is the Einstein-Hilbert one, for example, or the other ones, plus an integral over the matter of the matter Lagrangian Lm. Right? So that's our total action, which includes matter as well. So now, they didn't fix this one. So now if you do delta S with respect to the metric, okay, we know that delta S Einstein-Hilbert, so delta S equals to delta S with respect to the metric. So the Einstein-Hilbert path just gives us the Einstein equation, the Einstein tensor. So this is equal to d4 of x square root of minus g. And then I have g mu nu delta g mu nu plus the boundary term. And there is a 1 over 16 pi here, 16 pi g. OK, so that's the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert part. And then we vary the matter part of the action with respect to the metric. But that should be familiar. We have done that already a long time ago. And this gives us the t mu nu, right? That's how we define the t mu nu. All right, so that's this. And there was a this minus 1/2. You remember that? It's minus 1/2 t mu nu delta g mu nu. And so, no surprise, we have a beautiful equation in the presence of matter. So our Einstein equations are just g mu nu equals to 8 pi g g mu nu. Where the t mu nu is the matter Einstein, the matter energy momentum tensor. Okay? And that's how you do it. So, you know, adding matter is easy peasy once we know how to actually write down the action for the gravitational field. So again, this is the most important part of this lecture, is that, of course, it's the Einstein equation of the whole course. We are living in greatness. This is the most important part of the course. All right. So questions? So let me have, again, several remarks on this. So the first remark is trivial. So remember that when we were deriving that the energy momentum tensor is conserved, right? So what did we say? Well, we said that the action which we start with is diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, and so then we said this diffeomorphism induces some variation of the field and induces some variation of the metric. So now we said, when the equations of motion for the field are satisfied, the variation with respect to the field goes away. And all we are left with is the variation with respect to the metric. But we know what the form, actually, this variation of the metric takes. It's just given by the diffeomorphism. And that, by integration by parts, gave us that nabla mu t mu nu equals to 0. OK, so now let's do this for the Einstein-Hilbert action. OK. Now I start with the Einstein-Hilbert action. Is this diffeomorphism invariant? It is, right? So if I vary this with respect to the metric induced by the diffeomorphism, I have to get 0. So note that if I do a diffeomorphism, so doing a diffeomorphism on the Einstein-Hilbert action, I have to get that I have a 0 is delta S Einstein-Hilbert, right? Because it's diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, and then, of course, this is nothing else than proportional to d4 of x square root of g mu nu delta g mu nu. But delta g mu nu is induced by my diffeomorphism x to x minus xi. Okay, so this is delta g mu nu, but I can write this as 2 times nabla mu xi nu, precisely as we did previously. That's my diffeomorphism generating the coordinate transformation. Okay, now there is no path for the matter, right? Because I'm just varying this action, and this must be true. Okay, so I'm not imposing any equations of motion. So now this is symmetric in mu and nu, so I can get rid of the symmetrization here, and I can integrate by parts. So this is proportional to, well, let's write a minus sign so that we know that this is by integration by parts. But of course, there are some factors. but it's nabla mu, g mu nu, and then xi nu, right? Well, this has to be zero. So you are concluding that this guy has to be zero. So in other words, you are getting the Bianchi identity automatically from the fact that the Einstein-Hilbert action is diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, so we have the Bianchi identity nabla mu g mu nu equals to zero, just as a consequence of the fact that our action is diffeomorphism invariant. And now this is irrespective of any field equations. We haven't imposed any field equations whatsoever. There is no matter field equations which we had to set equal to zero. And there is no gravitational field equations imposed neither, right? So this is for any metric. Irrespective of Einstein equations.
Why the Einstein-Hilbert action have to morph my...
Well, it does, right? So it's a scalar. We started with a richer scalar. So it is a scalar. It doesn't change under coordinates. So yeah. All right, so we have the Bianchi identity true for any metric whatsoever. Any metric I plug into G mu nu, it will satisfy this. Okay, and that's no equations of motion are imposed. All right, so that's the first remark, which comes from the variational principle. Second remark is that let's use this, right? So I have my Einstein equation written over here, and I can apply nabla mu on both sides. Okay, so now the consistency condition. Consistency condition. So of Einstein equation. Well, I apply nabla mu on both sides of this equation. Apply nabla mu. On both sides, so then we have g mu nu equals to 8 pi g g mu nu, right? So I'm applying nabla mu on both sides of this. So then this thing, when I apply it here, it has to be zero. It's zero identically for any metric whatsoever, right? So this thing here is zero. And so what you are getting out of that is that, of course, the right-hand side also have to be zero by consistency, right? So then you are getting nabla mu, t mu nu, yeah, just a second. Nabla mu, t mu nu equals to zero. That's the consistency condition for my Einstein equations. If this is not true, the Einstein equations won't be satisfied, right? This is simply necessary condition for me to be able to write down the Einstein equation.
I don't really understand what happens with the boundary term in our Hilbert
action. Ah, very good. So that's a good question. I wanted to sweep it under the carpet, but the answer is very simple. So what you are doing is that you are doing a diffeomorphism. You are changing x to x minus xi. Xi is an arbitrary vector. Okay. So now what you can of course do is that if you have a boundary, you can say my xi is everywhere non-trivial, whatever arbitrary xi, apart from the xi on the boundary. I have to impose that my variation of the coordinates vanishes on the boundary. So xi is zero on the boundary. If I impose that, then all the boundary terms vanish. And you are fine. So of course, on the boundary, if I have zero xi, I have also zero variation of my metric there. And then everything goes through. So you have copied the general diffeomorphism, apart from that you have to impose boundary condition. For the diffeomorphism. All right, so now you see that I get the energy momentum conservation simply out of Einstein equations. It's a consistency equation for the Einstein equations. Okay, so this is the right way, not the Einstein way. Of course, the Einstein way is that Einstein said, well, I know that most of the t mu nu's are conserved, So I'm searching for a tensor which is also conserved. Okay? But that was just, you know, trying to find the equation. But the right way, of course, is this one here. I know what the Einstein equations are. I know that this is true by the diffeomorphism invariance of my Einstein-Hilbert action. And this simply has to be true. So I can only couple such matter to gravity which satisfies this. Okay? But at the same time, we know that this thing is nothing else than basically the equation of motion for the matter. Right? So this is a T mu conservation. T mu conservation. But this is nothing else than basically an equation of motion for the matter. So it's an equation of motion for matter. That's what we have seen yesterday. We got Navier-Stokes equations out of conservation of the corresponding thing. Okay. And so this very fact is the origin of what people say that the Einstein equations actually play a double agent role. Okay, so this is the origin of double agent role of Einstein equations. Of Einstein equations. Equations. Part of the interview question. Okay, so what do I mean by double agent role? Of course, the Einstein equations can be, you know, understood as field equations for the metric, right? So given the forces, given the T mu nu, I just find what my metric is. Okay, so one way to read Einstein equations is that the matter determines determines how the space is curved. In this way, you are looking at the Einstein equations as the field equations for the metric. These are field equations for metric. So I specify the sources, I specify what T mu nu is, I solve this equation, and then I find what the metric is, how the space-time is curved. Okay? But you see that the consistency equation for this is also this. And we know that this is the equation of motion for the matter. So at the same time, the Einstein equations contain information about how matter moves in the curved space-time. So at the same time, we know, so determine how matter moves in curved space. So that's the role of the equations of motion, equations of motion for the matter. Okay, and so that's why these are the most beautiful equations ever in physics, right? Because in any field theory, in Maxwell theory, you have two sets of equations. You have the field equations for Maxwell field, and then you have equations of motion for electron. And they are two separate equations which are distinct. However, the Einstein equations, just one equation, knows about everything. Okay, so these are really the most beautiful equations in physics. They determine both. You just need one set of equations, and you have all the information there.
I don't like the fact that when you have d mu nu equals zero, when there's no matter, you're still having a metric. So it means that you're still having your space, but you don't have matter. But the matter is the one that you have space. So.
Uh-huh. Okay, so very good. So, however, you should be thinking about that the gravity is also matter. So gravity actually also gravitates, right? And so even if you are in flat space, if r mu equals to zero, actually it doesn't mean that the space is empty. The space can be easily filled with gravitational field. and this gravitational field suddenly, you know, back reacts on itself and curves the space. Okay, so you shouldn't be thinking about vacuum solutions as empty solutions. Of course, empty solution is the flat space. But then you have other solutions which are vacuum solutions, like gravitational waves. But of course, certainly gravitational waves are not an empty space. You have an empty space and the gravitational wave. Or Schwarzschild solution, which is a solution for the black hole. It's a vacuum solution, but of course it's filled with the gravitational field of the black hole or whatever. Right? So yeah. All right, so you know, this is what comes here. All right, so that was the most exciting remark. Number two, remark number three is how many equations do we have? So now, of course, this is related to the remark when we discussed the Maxwell theory, is that we wrote down 8 equations for 6 unknowns E and B. So then we said, well, how to reconcile this problem is that we said, actually, only 6 out of those equations are true evolution equations, and then we have 2 constraints, 2 initial data or whatever, 2 constraints, right? So now the question is, how many equations are Einstein equations, and are they all true evolution equations? So how many equations do we get? Then, of course, right? So Einstein equations are 10 equations. Okay. The question is, are all of these actually true evolution equations? And so the immediate answer would be, well, maybe not. I can actually make 4 coordinate transformations. I can change my 4 coordinates to anything I want. So naively, you would expect that 4 equations actually are not true evolution equations. I can kill them by doing some coordinate transformation. They shouldn't describe physics, right? And that's the correct statement. So only 6, however, only 6 are evolution equations. And so let me just have a very crude definition of what I mean by evolution equation is that, of course, our equations are second order for the metric. So that means that what I will call an evolution equation, if I have terms which depend on 2 derivatives of the metric with respect to time. Okay, so only 6 of them contain second derivatives of the metric with respect to time. That let's call that evolution equation. Okay. And then the remaining 4 are actually constraints. And that means that they don't depend on 2 derivatives of the metric with respect to time. All right. So how do we see that? Oh, no. All right. So how do we see this? The simplest way is to use the Bianchi identity. Okay, so to see this, use the Bianchi identity, which is lambda mu g mu nu equals to 0 identically for any metric. Okay, so now let me choose the coordinates where I really consider the time to be the first coordinate, and then I have the other coordinates to be special coordinates. So now I choose my coordinates x mu. I call them t and xi, and then I'll be looking which of the equations actually can contain 2 derivatives of with respect to time and which of them don't. All right, and so now you can write this explicitly down. So let's write it down for nu equal to t. Oh, we don't actually even have to do that. let's just write it down here. So we will have nabla t gt nu here. Of course, nabla t gt nu, it's partial t gt nu plus gamma gamma term. Okay, so we will have, so this writes as dt of gt nu plus gamma gamma term. The gamma gamma term is gamma t t mu g mu nu plus gamma nu t mu. So this is just nabla t gt nu. Okay, so I just plug for mu equal to t, but then also I have to write down with the other ones. So it's plus nabla I gi nu, and then this is equal to zero. Yeah.
Isn't there a t? I mean, in the second.
Yeah, something missing there. Thank you. I am missing something. Gt mu. Thank you so much. Other mistakes? Okay. So now what you of course want to do is we want to write our equations and we look at the following Einstein equations. They will be g t nu equals to 8 pi g t d nu, right? So now the statement is that these four equations, I can run nu from 0 to 3. So these four equations are precisely the constraints. So the statement is these are constraints. Okay, if they were not constraints, they would have to contain second derivatives of the metric, okay, with respect to time. So now let's go and assume that this is not true. Let's say that these are true evolution equations. So if not true, if evolution equations, then g t nu actually depends on two derivatives of the metric, right? If they were evolution equations, then this would have to be true. All right. But if this were true, then if you look at this equation here, I am taking a time derivative of this. Okay, so this time would then be three derivatives of the metric with respect to time. So then this thing here would contain three derivatives of the metric with respect to time. If these were evolution equations, then this would have three derivatives of the metric. Okay, then I look at the rest. Okay, so now if I am looking at the rest, of course, g mu nu only depends on two derivatives. This depends only on one derivative. So this cannot have three derivatives with respect to time. This cannot have three derivatives with respect to time. And this is a spatial derivative. So it cannot have three derivatives with respect to time. So, but the rest only up to two derivatives. To d squared t of g, right? Because the rest, I am not doing any time differentiation anymore, right? So I am doing only spatial derivatives, or I'm not doing any more derivatives. So the rest of this equation, this thing here, actually can have, what is this here? Okay, we don't need that. So this thing here can only have two derivatives with respect to time, whereas this one, if those are evolution equations, has three. But this is an identity. Identity means 1 equal to 1 or 0 equal to 0. Okay? So what it means is that if I have some terms with three derivatives with respect to time, I will have to have another term which has three derivatives with respect to time, and they eat each other. And then they cancel, and then there's nothing, and I get 0 equal to 0. Okay? So this has to be a 0 equal to 0 identity. But I can't satisfy it here, because the rest doesn't have three derivatives with respect to time, but that one has. But this is impossible. So impossible to satisfy. To satisfy. And so our assumption that these are evolution equations are wrong, and they have to be constraints. All right? So think about this proof. It's quite sticky. But if you think about it many times, you will convince yourself many times that it's actually wrong, the proof. But it's not wrong. It's correct.
I know a bunch of differential, like.
Now, this is not a differential equation. No. This is not a differential equation for the metric. If it were a differential equation for the metric, then it would constrain the metric, right? It would have to tell me my metric is this. But this is not a differential equation for the metric. This is an identity. It's 0 equals to 0.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So it cannot impose any constraints on the metric because it's a Bianchi identity. It's valid for any metric. Yeah. Right? So it must be an identity. It's not a differential equation for the metric.
Okay. Next.
All right. Questions? Isn't this super neat and super nice stuff? But it's also, you know, okay. Very good. So, now the blackboard is wet, then it's a disaster. All right, so now, despite the fact that nabla mu t mu d equals to 0 is not conservation, really, people still call it conservation of energy momentum tensor. And then, you know, we more or less claim that this is more like an equation of motion. So the question is there anything conserved? Okay, so that's a remark. This was remark number what?
Three.
So let's have remark number 4. And that's the conservation laws. Four conservation laws.
So for yep. Uh-huh. This does not tell us the rest 6 are evolution equations, right? Like this is only saying 4 of them can't be.
Yeah. That's right. No, that's right.
Is there a way to see why the rest have to be evolution?
So this, you know, I'm using the Bianchi identity to say these 4 are not. I don't know. It's true that the rest are evolution equations. As you will see very explicitly when you actually discuss the Hamiltonian formulation, where you really say I have to specify my surface, where I specify the metric on the surface, which, and then the derivative of the metric, and you'll see that you have precisely, you can write down 6 evolution equations for what happens. So you know, but then you have to do lots of work. Right, so this is just for free, right? So you don't have to do anything to realize that you at least have 4 constraints. All right, so the conservation laws. So we have the law nabla mu t mu nu equals to 0 again. So now the question is this a conservation law of anything? Is anything conserved? So is anything conserved here? Is anything conserved? What do you think?
Kind of depends, right? Because when you think of it from the point of view of just putting a t-mu, how we did in the fluid, that equation actually made some equations of motion for the fluid, right? But if you have to, if it comes from a higher action, that equation doesn't depend on the equation of motions for the higher action. It only depends on the deformorphism invariant of the way that you wrote the action, right?
Okay.
So on one side, like conservation laws are usually associated to being conserved along some particular motion. So for the fluid, it seems like it would. For the other things, it seems like it wouldn't. Like it would be an identity.
Okay. Good try. Okay. So the answer is no. So the answer is no. And there is many ways how you can see that nothing is conserved. The simplest one is you don't have to understand anything but mass. And then actually you may be asking, well, actually, is there a Stokes theorem which would transform this to something which is conserved on some surface, right? Which would be conserved in this time and it would be equal to something else in later time. And the statement is, so then you go to a mathematical book and try to find a Stokes theorem for a rank 2 tensor, which is symmetric in mu and nu. And so can I trade this to a surface integral? Okay, the answer is no. You will not find any such theorem because there is no such theorem. So Stokes theorem does not exist. For, and so now our object is symmetric in mu and nu. So if we have an object which is symmetric in mu and nu, then there is no corresponding Stokes theorem which would turn my volume integral to a surface one, and so I cannot find anything conserved. Okay? And it's because this guy is symmetric. If you had an antisymmetric object, if you had a form, then of course you have Stokes theorem. But the mu nu is not antisymmetric, it's symmetric. Okay, so that's why mathematically there is no such thing. Of course, so now you have the answer. Mass never lies. So now you better find a physical reason why nothing is conserved. And of course, the physical reason is precisely what we were discussing a minute ago. So the mu nu is the energy momentum tensor for the matter. But the space-time is filled with two entities. It's filled with the matter, and it's filled with the gravitational field. Of course, these two interact together. Okay, and so it of course makes sense that only the total energy density or the total energy is conserved, that of matter plus of gravitational field. Well, this only describes part of that. It only describes the matter, right? So the whole thing cannot be conserved, right? So only the total energy of matter plus gravitational field can be conserved, right? Can be conserved. Not only the part for the matter, right? They certainly, you know, there's a gravitational energy, right? So the gravitational energy plus the energy of the object is conserved, but not separate, right? So that's the physical reason. I don't know. I don't really have time to discuss that. By the way, what would you expect? Okay, let's discuss that. It's quite neat. What would you expect the energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field should look like? Okay, can you actually write down what the energy of gravitational field is? What do you think?
Something.
Oh, that's a very good guess. You could say maybe capital G mu is something like energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field. That's a very good guess. But the truth is, okay, so let's go by an analogy. Exists four. Okay. So let's see, you know, what the gravitational, let's say, proposal for gravitational energy. So if I can find such an object, gravitational energy, then maybe I can take, you know, this energy momentum tensor, I can add it to the energy momentum tensor of the matter, and the whole thing should be conserved, and so then I will have a conservation, right? So what is the proposal for the gravitational energy? Let's just have a very crude argument in analogy with the Maxwell field. So for Maxwell, and for gravity, okay. And so we know that for Maxwell, the basic field is the potential, right? So phi and A, right? So let's just do electrostatics to simplify our life. Doesn't matter. So we have phi. So then the strength of the field is just the electric intensity or the magnetic intensity. So it's gradient of phi. Okay, so E, something like A d of phi, right? I take a gradient of phi, and that's the electric field. So now how do I calculate the energy density for the electromagnetic field? It's E squared. Perfect. So then you have the energy density, and that goes like E squared by plus B squared. So it goes like d phi squared. Okay, so that's the proposal for energy density, and maybe then I can form a tensor out of that. That will be our team mu nu for electromagnetic field, and that will be a generalization of this. Right? So now for gravity, let's go the same way. The field is the metric, right? So we have a metric here. So then the strength of the field is a derivative of the metric. So it's a Christoffel symbol. Okay, so G gamma is V of G. That's the strength of the field. So by analogy, the energy density for the gravitational field must be something like gamma squared. Okay, so that's the density of the energy of the gravitational field. Well, that's perfect. But you see immediately a problem, right? This is not bloody a tensor. It's something which I can make to vanish in the freely falling frame. So what it actually tells you is that, you know, the perception of the gravitational energy depends on the frame I measure it. If I'm in the freely falling frame, I will see, addressed to gravitational field, no energy whatsoever. If I am not in the freely falling frame, I will address something else, all right? So this is not a tensor. So gravity, gravitational energy is not localized. It depends on the frame. I look at it, and I can get different results.
Isn't it possible to construct a tensor for it?
We will see next week. It's a very good question. So the answer is no and yes. So not really. Not really. So anyway, this is the argument, right? So the argument why you cannot really do it is that this will not be a tensor, and I cannot localize the gravitational energy. And so this is the first hint that actually gravity is very special. It's not local. It's actually holographic. Okay? So gravity is holographic. And I don't mean this in the sense of ADS-CFT. I mean that it actually makes sense to talk about it. So if you want to talk about the gravity in some region, actually the information can be captured on the boundary of that region, rather than at a point of that region. Okay, so really gravity is holographic, and I cannot really write down a tensor for gravitational energy, and it comes from here. So actually there comes the hope that maybe I can upgrade this T mu nu to T mu nu plus gravity, so that this will give me a conservation of energy. So now I'm telling you it cannot be done. Next week we will construct it. Okay, but the trick will be that the result is not a tensor. Okay, and it cannot be a tensor because it's something like gamma square, right? All right, so we have that. So now, but then you may say, well, wait a minute. So mathematics tells me I cannot construct. Well, there is nothing conserved because I don't have the Stokes theorem. Physics tells me, well, actually, shouldn't happen that anything should be conserved because I haven't considered the energy of gravitational field, right? So then you maybe start thinking, okay, is there a general principle which would tell me actually there is something conserved or there is nothing conserved? And of course, the general principle is the Noether's theorem. Okay, and the Noether's theorem tells me I'll find conserved quantities if there are some symmetries, global continuous symmetries. Right? So global continuous symmetries give me conserved quantities. But do I have any global continuous symmetries here? What do you think? Huh? Are they global? No, they are local symmetries, right? So the answer is no. If I have a general curved space, I don't have any symmetries whatsoever. The general curved manifold has no symmetries. Okay, and so because there are no symmetries, nothing is conserved in general spacetime, right? If I am in flat space, well, I have lots of symmetries, right? I have Lorentz transformations, whatever, Lorentz symmetries. I can do a translation, it's the same thing. I can do a rotation, it's the same thing. But if you have general curved manifold, there is no symmetries whatsoever, right? That's why, well, okay, let's not go there. So you have notions of particles in quantum field theory based on symmetries. You classify particles based on that. Well, no symmetries in curved space. So all that is wrong, right? All right, so in general space-time, there are no symmetries, no any global continuous symmetries and so you cannot expect by Noether's theorem, so Noether does not imply any conservation. Okay, so that's the statement. So you have this beautiful equation, but nothing can be conserved because my spacetime is general curved spacetime. I have no symmetry, so I cannot expect anything to be conserved, right? Okay, but of course, if I do have global continuous symmetries, then I should have some conserved quantities, right? So now how the global continuous symmetries are described is precisely by these Killing vectors, the Killing vector equation, which we've seen a couple lectures ago. Okay, so symmetries in GR correspond to Killing vectors. So they have to satisfy the Killing vector equation, nabla mu xi nu, nabla nu psi mu equals to zero. Okay, so if I have such a vector in my spacetime, well, that's my symmetry, then I better have some conserved quantity for my matter fields, right? And so then you may be looking at a quantity, well, let's look at j mu. Let's define t mu nu psi nu. Okay, so I take my t mu nu of the energy momentum tensor for the matter, and I contract it with my Killing vector, I get an object with j mu. Okay, so now let's look at if this is conserved. So is it a conserved current or not? Is it nabla mu j mu equals to zero? Okay, I have two terms. I have nabla mu t mu nu psi nu, and then I differentiate the other one. It's t mu nu nabla mu psi nu. Right? What about the first term? Huh? It's zero because my t mu nu is conserved. Right? So this is zero because nabla mu t mu nu equals to zero. What about the second term?
It can be symmetrized because Tmunu is symmetric.
Uh-huh. So I can symmetrize it here because Tmunu is symmetric.
And then that gives 0 by the killing equation.
And then this is the killing equation. Nabla mu xi nu plus nabla nu xi mu. So this is 0 because of the killing equation. Killing. Okay, so this is 0. So now I have constructed a conserved current. But if I have conserved current, I have conserved charge. Right, so this is our conserved current. Conserved current. And this yields, by standard calculation, the conserved charge. Okay. So in other words, to any killing vector, if I find one killing vector xi this direction, I will have a conserved charge. If I find a killing vector this direction, I will have another conserved charge. Okay. So I have that many conserved charges as that is how many I have killing vectors in the spacetime. So now, in flat space, in particular, you know that the translations leave the thing invariant. So I have a translation with respect to x direction, y direction, z direction, time directions. Okay, so that's my symmetries. That's my killing vectors. I can move along x direction or y direction or z direction. That's my killing vector. Of course, then this thing will apply, and I will have conserved energy, conserved angular momentum with respect to the x direction, y direction, and z direction. Okay, the conservation of energy and momentum charges in flat space is trivial because you have that many killing vectors. But in curved space, there is nothing like that unless you have the corresponding symmetry described by the killing vector. Yes?
How can I see that this is global?
How can you see that that is global?
That the symmetry is global.
Good point. Let me think about it.
Another question. What is the meaning of a conserved current of what? Like physically, what is the conserved current?
It depends on what the Tmunu is, right? What kind of matter I consider. So that's a very good question. So specifically, if you take Tmunu just for a particle, then what do you think you will find the conserved charges?
It depends on what theta is as well, right? On what psi is as well, right? I mean, for example, if psi is like this, then it would be angular momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Two more size translations, then it would be energy momentum.
That's right. But okay, very good, very good. So then, you know, I take Tmu nu for the particle. I write this J mu, which is Tmu nu xi nu, right? And so what you'll find is that the corresponding conserved charge is like a zero component of J mu, right? You integrate the charge density over a volume. So you integrate J zero over a volume, and that's your conserved charge, right? So now for a particle, you find that this conserved charge C is the forward velocity of the particle times this thing here. Okay, so this is the specific case of this procedure here. And of course, we already know that this is conserved for particles if you have a killing vector. This is the forward velocity of the particle, and this is the corresponding killing vector, and that's the conserved quantity. So this is a special case of this. Okay. And of course, depending on what xi is, I will have conserved energy or conserved angular momentum or conserved anything else, right? All right. So I had one more thing to discuss. Have you read Winnie the Pooh? Okay, it's like these kid stories about a bear who lives near the forest. And the bear is a little bit stupid, so it's a bear of a little bit, you know, of a little brain. And so, but he's quite clever at the same time. And he loves honey, and he would do anything for honey and whatever. So anyway, you know, he always has a great idea, and then the idea then breaks for some reason. And so one great idea could be is that if you want to solve the Einstein equations, right, this is our equations, G mu nu, A pi G, G mu nu, then maybe I can take any metric, okay? And if I take any metric, I calculate what capital G mu nu is, okay? And then I find corresponding G mu nu, Okay? So then I solve the Einstein equations. Right? So whatever I get on the left-hand side, I set it equal to 8 pi g t mu nu, and I'll say this is the source for my metric. Okay, so that's the Pooh's way of solving Einstein equations. Okay, so he just, you know, takes whatever the metric he likes, and then he says, well, this solves Einstein equations with this t mu nu, which I just get from the Einstein equation. So now, why this does not quite work is that such a t mu nu will be typically quite ugly. If you take any metric and you do this, you find ugly t mu nu. And so what I mean by ugly t mu nu is that, for example, the energy density of the t mu nu, of such t mu nu, will be negative. Okay, so for example, you get that, you know, energy density of something of your favorite metric is negative. And then, of course, people consider this unphysical. Okay, negative energy density, what the hell does it mean? So then, in order to prevent such things, and of course, these are quite interesting solutions you can get here. You can get something like warp drives. If you read sci-fi, you know what a warp drive is. I can travel faster than light and whatever. But for that, I need some t mu nu, which is actually unphysical, which has negative energy density or something like that. Or I can get wormholes. I can get from one place in the space-time to another place in the space-time through a shortcut, through a wormhole. And unfortunately, wormhole is also supported by some strange t mu nu. So now, in order to say that these solutions are not physical, you say these t mu nus, I just forbid them based on some criteria. The criteria are called energy conditions. So energy condition is something which I impose on t mu nu to prevent these solutions to exist. Okay, so now there is lots of energy conditions you can impose. You can pick basically your favorite energy condition. There is null energy condition, strong energy condition, dominant energy condition, and they are all here to prevent Pooh's way of solving the Einstein equations and to prevent some solutions to exist as unphysical solutions. All right, so now, however, there's a problem. If these energy conditions, these are conditions on the t mu nu, they are conditions on the matter, right? And so you may be asking, where do these conditions come from, right? And so it's matter. So the best theory for matter which we have is the quantum field theory. So then you say, well, it must be some property of quantum field theory for the matter, right? Then you go and you say, well, OK, so if anybody knows anything about the quantum field theory, it's Weinberg. So you open his book and search for energy conditions, right? And so then you go through the first volume and you don't see any. And then you go through the second volume and third volume and you don't see any. So then actually, what the hell, right? So the energy conditions do not follow from quantum field theory. They are not property of the matter. So what they are, right? So now the strange thing is that nobody knows, right? So the energy conditions are basically the physical assumptions which we impose on the matter that they should be satisfied, right? But there is no any fundamental reason for them. They don't come from quantum field theory, because if they did, they would be contained in Weinberg's books, right? Okay. So what do we do? I don't know. So if you don't have any energy conditions imposed whatsoever, any metric will be a solution, and you can get any crazy solution you want, right? So what do we do? I don't know, right? So it's still an open question: is where the energy conditions come from? Can I really admit any solution of the Einstein equations as physical solution with the given t mu nu? Is Pooh's way the right way to solve Einstein equations? Does it tell me that I can always find a source for whatever metric I want? So that's the interesting question. Anyway, so let me stop here. Yeah?
Did Einstein know about the energy conditions?
I don't know. Maybe, probably, I don't know. I don't know. All right, so you will do the homework, linearized gravity. And then next week, we start the applications of linearized gravity. But you know, go as far as you can in your homework, and it will be useful for the next week discussion.